Hi, I'm retired NYPD Detective Vic Ferrari, and welcome to NYPD Through the Looking Glass, where you'll get unique insight into the New York City Police Department. Before we get started, please check out my Amazon author page. There you'll find my series of behind-the-scenes NYPD books for $10 paperback and $2.99 ebook download, including Grand Theft Auto, the NYPD's auto crime division. It's everything you wanted to know about the stolen car industry, car thieves, chop shops, organized crimes, recovering Mike Tyson's stolen Ducati motorcycle, and two young nuns that stole Mother Superior's car to go on a wild shopping spree in the Bronx. And that is a true story. So if you get a chance, check out my book on Amazon, Grand Theft Auto, the NYPD's auto crime division. On today's episode, we're going to change the format a little bit, and we're going to chat with former Los Angeles County Sheriff Cliff Yates. Hello, Cliff, and welcome to the show.
Vic, thanks for having me on. I want to be the first to recommend your books. They're fantastic, and I can tell you from a street cop point of view, they were right on, man. I was on the edge of my seat most of the time as if I was riding with you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Cliff, you've had quite the career in law enforcement over, I think, 36 or 37 years. Tell our listeners about yourself and how you got started in law enforcement and where you began.
Well, I grew up in upstate New York in a real rural little village, Caledonia, New York, and my dad was chief of police of our little village police department. And I ended up joining the Livingston County Sheriff's Department at age 21 in a real small department. Vic, we had 20 road deputies, as we call them, because we had like 20 in the jail, and then we had 20 that just worked for the road. So they hired separately. And it was just, I mean, I think we had 60,000 residents. I mean, we would put out on a night shift, three cars. But I always had it in my heart that I wanted to work for a large metropolitan agency. I think because of several movies about New York City and books that I read. And so I started applying around my fourth year with Livingston County. I was applying NYPD. I took the test in 1982. And LA Sheriff, LAPD, and Houston at the time was hiring, mass hiring. And I got hired by the LA County Sheriff first. So after 5 years of serving in the rural small department, I joined the largest sheriff's department in the world, the LA County Sheriff's Department.
Now, you said that you took the NYPD test. How close were you to becoming NYPD? How far in the process were you?
Well, actually, I didn't even get the written response until I was already in my backgrounds with LA Sheriff. I think like 5 months or 6 months since I took the written, I got the results back, and I was band three, so I knew it was going to be a while. So by the time I don't even think they had gotten to my band yet. I was already in the jail in Los Angeles County. And then I was getting very frustrated being in the jail. I started really hating my job because I just loved working patrol. So I was actually thinking of quitting and going to LAPD, or I just wanted to be back on the streets. And then I got a notice that said I could have my name put back on the list at NYPD. And so I flew back in 1987, and I flew back to New York, and I met a guy at the academy who was going to put me through a physical agility or something and put me back into the process. But he kind of talked me out of it, and so I ended up not doing it. I went back to LA, and I ended up going to patrol within about 2 months.
So now, a lot of people that don't work in law enforcement don't realize this. Sheriff's departments that run the city, the sheriff's departments also run the jails. And
right.
when you first get hired, they throw you in the jail because most guys want to be on the road. There are guys that just want to sit in the jail, but there are guys want to go on the road, and they know that. So basically, you're the new guy, and they throw you in the jail. In the NYPD, we used to have an expression when they gave you two choices, and it was really one. They used to say, all right, I got two choices for you, cake or cock, and we're all out of cake. So how big of a piece would you like? So
oh, that's
you got
great.
Hired, you really didn't have a choice. They put you in the jail, correct?
Yeah, yeah. You didn't have a choice.
How long were you in jail for?
I was in there for 3 years. I've seen people in there for like 6 or 7 years, and then there's people who were in there 6 months. You know, depends on how the rotation is going. There's 20 patrol stations, and there's 6 jail facilities. At the time, I think we were running like 16,000-17,000 inmates. And so for me, it ended up being 3 years. And I had in for the fastest stations. I picked the worst. What's the worst places to be? And I put in for those places. And it's all a matter of numbers. The first to come up is where you go.
Well, I think L.A. County Jail, I mean, it's famous, and I think it's one of the largest jails in the world.
It is, and then I worked the worst jail, the Men's Central Jail downtown at 6,000 inmates, and, you know, they actually run drugs in there. They pull hits in there. It's amazing. They pull murders in there. It's unbelievable. So, you know, for instance, if they want to pull a hit on somebody in the county jail, what they do is they have the lawyers they'll subpoena these guys that are doing life in like San Quentin. They subpoena them down as character witnesses so they can bring them down into the county jail system. And then somehow they get down in there and then they get out and they pull a hit on somebody in the jail. That's how they do it. And they run drugs in there. And you would think this is impossible. How could that happen? But it's like a crazy place. Now, in my first year, they opened up a new jail in the north part of the county, and they needed 80 bodies to open up this jail. And so I got sent up north, and then I ended up working in an old minimum security jail. And I loved it because we were outside the whole time. And it was actually like working a little city. There was a ballpark, there was a church, there was a school.
So those guys are the guys suspended driver's license, guy didn't pay the child support. They're going to do less than a year. So they
right.
put them there so they don't get slashed. They're not going to cause any problems. They're not going to escape.
Yeah. So this is actually where Robert Mitchum had done time in this jail, right? This is where like celebrities would go. They could be outside. And then they had a road crew, right? So they'd be along the freeway, cleaning the freeway. And that's how they got narcotics into the jail there. They would throw it along the freeway, and then the road crew would pick it up, and they would keister it, and they would bring it in. And so all this crazy stuff and things that you couldn't do today, we did. This is back in 1983. They actually had, like, they called it a group five. It was inmates that were doing discipline. It was like a chain gang. They actually would take them down and they would actually hit rocks and make little rocks out of big rocks. Of course, they couldn't do that today, but it was kind of wild. It was like from the old South, you know.
The only thing I know about the L.A. County Jail is what I've seen on television, and I think that television series Lock Up, they used to run it on MSNBC like 24-7. I think they did a couple of episodes there. Did they used to keep the gangs like the Crips and Bloods separated, or could they coexist in jail?
No, they did. They used to always keep the Bloods and Crips. There was a Blood module, a Crip module. Then they got away from that, and they just started – there was special housing units after that, I think in the 90s, they got away from strictly Crips, strictly Blood. They actually garnered a lot of power by doing that on the rows and stuff. They had shot callers on the row. They would decide, you know, I mean, this is I'll give you a scenario. You know, maybe the guys have been doing searches, and then the shot caller, you know, they would say they're coming to do a search, and the shot caller would tell, you know, then usually they would handcuff people, bring them out, and then they would search all the cells. Well, the shot caller would say, no, we're not doing that today. No, no more searches. Hey, wait, you know. And so then you'd have to get the lieutenant, and then sometimes you get a weak lieutenant. Well, what if we gave you ice cream or something, you know? You know, and then, no, there's too many searches. We're saying no. So the shot caller would tell everybody on the road, don't hook up. I mean, don't submit to handcuffing. So I remember it was my thing one time. I was the sergeant. I was on the extraction team. So, because when you get to a certain point, they try to negotiate, but eventually we got to go in and the fight's going to be on. And they know that, but that's how they kind of garner street cred. You know, they know kind of, I mean, they actually want an ass whooping to be happening because, you know, this is part of how they get street cred. So the shot caller was saying, no, nobody hook up, you know? And so then you go in, you got all helmeted up and you start with the first cell, man, they won't, you tell them to back up and be handcuffed. Nope, come get me. And then you'd have to go in and then. You know, but before you get there, though, then they start throwing, you know, urine-filled cups at you and crap and feces.
And tears.
And then, you know what? And then it was kind of funny. So, especially the Mexican gangs, you know, a lot of force would be used, right? These guys, you know, have to have the medical team come up. And then as a sergeant, you got to interview people. You know, okay, we use force on you. And, you know, what happened? And these Mexican gangs, man, they were so bravado. Nothing happened. No, the deputies came in, you refuse, and they, you know, you got a bruise here. I fell down. They wouldn't even say deputies used, you know, even though we have it on video. But no, they would say, no, nothing happened. And that's just was like the code, man. They just knew, hey, we have to tell you on today we're not submitting. It was kind of a power thing, kind of a weird way the jail is run. Weird.
You would think, yeah, I mean, in today's day and age, every time somebody gets a boo-boo, they're looking to sue somebody in law enforcement. And like you said,
yeah,
those guys just didn't even want to admit that it happened.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, in the jail, it's all about the main currency is respect, you know. And, you know, if you give them respect, they gave you respect. And it just kind of went that way. You know, everybody kind of knew their place. And really, there wasn't a lot of trouble compared to what was going on, man. But I mean, we had crazy things happen in that jail. Huh?
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Did you have any homicides or a lot of slashings in there during your time there?
Yeah. We had one. So the one, the guy, he must have got to the phone and he called his attorney, right? And the attorney called the jail and he said, hey, listen, my guy's in this row. You know, his three cellmates are murdered. They're underneath the bunks, you know. They go down there, sure enough, all three were stabbed, and, you know. So what would happen is a lot of times, and I don't know what they finally got around this, so the guys would come back to court, and so what they would do is they would come back to their row, you know, and they would tell the jailer, the head guy, you know, he would say, you know, cell 40 or whatever, you know, and then the guy would say, okay, and he would open it up. That guy's not even from that tier, so if he didn't check him, the guy would walk down, he'd go in there and he'd pull the hit on those guys in there because they knew where they were. So they would get like people's booking numbers and they would have their family members run them to see what they're in for, where they're at. So they would locate people and pull hits. Weird.
And what you, like Rikers Island in New York City, what people don't realize is there's a difference between jail and prison. So
right.
Every county has a county jail. So when you first get arrested, you know, you see a judge, if you can't make bail or they're not going to give you bail, you go to jail. And you
right.
sit there until your trial date. Well, like you said, if you're already upstate on another crime, they can bring you back down as a witness or say you did.
Yeah.
You have multiple homicides, you're up for one homicide, they bring you back to try you again. But you would think, and jails are different. So, and sometimes it's, like I said earlier, it's guys that are, you know, wife beaters or guys that didn't pay child support or suspended license. They're only going to do a year because I think in most places, if you do a year and a day, you're going upstate. If you're doing under a year, they'll keep you in the jail. You're close to home. Just keep your mouth shut. Stay out
yeah.
of trouble. Don't, you know, don't screw up where you add time on and then you can go upstate. When you were there, did you have any high profile inmates?
Yeah, they called them like, we had a section called high power. And so any like major celebrities or, you know, major serial killers that were, you know, they just couldn't be with other people, then they were in a separate section. Even other deputies couldn't go in there without, you know, you have to get permission or, you know, they would make sure no one's trying to get in. So deputies had to be handpicked to work in there. And because, I mean, there would be guys in there, they were in there for 5-6 years waiting for their trial to come up, you know, and they might have been a mass murderer, a serial killer. And so I never worked a high power area, but we did have a specific area for that. I'm trying to remember some of the high power people.
Robert Downey Jr. or Suge Knight.
Correct.
Floating around.
Yeah, all those guys were separated and they were, yeah, because, you know, you got to be careful. Deputies would even be trying to get in there to see him or talk to him. So they had main control over that, so.
So it must have been a breath of fresh air for you after you're doing time in jail and you're allowed to go back, hit the road. What was that like for you?
That was so great. You know, well, you know, I was kind of happy that at first I didn't want to leave this worst jail. But then when I got up to that minimum security, you know, that was really good because it really helped me get ready for patrol. Because now I'm like I said, it was like a little city. You know, we go in and now we have a ballpark. Everybody's in barracks. Every barracks has like 100 people in these barracks. And they have a school and they have a shop and all this stuff. And there's sometimes be riots in there. But most, like you say, most of the people wanted to get out. They're getting out in less than a year. So they didn't want another escape charge. That'd be another year tacked on. But, and so what was nice about it, like I said, they would get dope in there. And so you would actually be on a foot beat with another deputy and you had radios and you would, you know, you'd stop people and search them. You find people with like tar heroin. And then you would actually arrest them in the jail as if you're on the street and take them to a harder lockup. And you'd write a police report. So you were already getting involved in writing police reports and you'd actually be going to court already as a jail deputy testifying about a court case involving possession of narcotics. So it was a good preparation. I liked it. But I had had enough after 2 years. So that's why I was. So when I went out to patrol, I ended up going to Linwood Station, which is Compton PD adjacent. And so like you were bringing up earlier, most, I think by law, all counties have to have a sheriff's department to maintain a jail, but they're not required to have a patrol division. But most departments also have a patrol division. So in LA County, we not only have a patrol division for county areas that are unincorporated, but also cities within LA County would contract for us to be their police department. So we'd have a private contract like West Hollywood, the city of West Hollywood. They don't have their own PD. They have the sheriff. So they pay for so many patrol cars, you know, bike patrol and canines and traffic cars. And then they also get the benefit of, you know, we have our other resources that they get to use a lot of times for free if something goes down big. So I went to the city of Linwood, which used to have their own police department. They went under and they contracted for us. And I went there and it was just a city with a lot of gangs in it and a lot of shootings. It was the cocaine wars like you went through in the 80s. And so it was it was fast moving, man, and so much different than upstate New York. Crazy.
Well, I'm sure Linwood or Compton is like the equivalent of Brooklyn North.
Yeah.
New York City, we got the five boroughs. And I always tell the story where I worked in the South Bronx and then Harlem for a while. And I thought I was a badass. And then they start flying out to Brooklyn for, we had the Crown Heights riots, and we'll get into that later. And I was like, holy shit, like, you know, Brooklyn's bad. Like, Brooklyn's worse than the Bronx and Harlem. So I'm guessing Compton was your equivalent to Brooklyn.
Yeah, it was funny, right? So these, you know, all these gang shootings are going on when I get there. And at the time, we're sporting wheel guns, right? We got a Model 1538 wheel gun. And all these drive-by shootings, a lot of times they just left their weapons, man. These were the AK-47s, man. These gang members are sporting AKs and Mac-10s, Mac-9s. And we have these little 38s, you know. It was crazy.
Did you at least have speed loaders? Or no, you had the dump?
Yeah, we had speedy loaders. And everybody had a backup gun. And but then we finally went to the Beretta 92Fs, the 9mm, which I liked. Yeah, but we were outgunned from the beginning. Those gangs, man, they had all sorts of weapons, man.
The funny thing, like coming working at NYPD, we always were under the impression, and I think I'm right, the California police agencies always seem to be 5 years ahead of us equipment-wise. Like, it took forever. I mean, I was a cop for 7 years. We didn't go to 9mm until 94, 95 when everybody was getting them. I didn't see a taser until around 2000, and it wasn't just patrol cops carried them. We didn't. The sergeants carried. This is a funny story. So LAPD, I know they used to carry those ridiculous sex toys or PR-24s.
No, we had them too. Yeah, we had PR-24s.
Yeah, we had the nightsticks, right? And then 94, 95, somebody came up with the bright idea with the PR-24s, and we had to get these things. We had to go through all the training, and they just didn't work for us. And thank God, probably about 4 or 5 years in, we went back to the nightsticks. And the NYPD, when you're in the police academy, I mean, you buy all your equipment up front, and I got this little, it was like a balsa wood nightstick, right? And the first thing you do when you get out of the police academy is that goes in your garage. And you go out, you buy a Coca-Bolo, the really heavy-duty nightstick, because the regular nightstick that they give you really just isn't going to do the job. And
yeah, we had the PR-24s, and a lot of supervisors didn't like it, but there's nothing they could do. If you were trained like I had prior training in the straight stick, they called it. So by policy, we could carry the straight stick. We called it Old Hickory. So we had the wooden nightstick. But, you know, not everybody could carry that, only if you had been trained in it. And that was the policy of the department. So, I mean, supervisors would jam, you can't carry that. Oh, yeah, I can. And you'd have to educate them. But, I mean, it was very few. I carried the straight stick for a long time, and so did some other guys who had been with other agencies, and they had been trained in them. But most everybody went to... So you had to have that PR-24 with you. So guys always, I could show you pictures. It was always wedged between the door rest, the armrest, and the door window, and was sticking with a side handle because no one wanted to carry it on them. But you had to have it with you at all times in the car. And then everybody carried a sap, right? Those leather filled with BB's thing. It was like a big sap. But that's what everybody used.
Well, yeah, in law enforcement with civil liability, you're supposed to be, they demand it, you're supposed to be trained. Like you said, you had to be trained on something before you could carry it. I remember when I first got hired, right? There was guys walking around with contraptions that I had never seen before. And I remember like guys with like 7 or 8 years on the job telling me, just don't follow these old timers. They're going to get sued. Like, just like you said, the saps, the jacks, Mr. Sandman was, it was a glove, a leather glove with iron filings sewed into the knuckles. These are a lot of the old timers. I mean, when I got hired, there were still guys in their early 60s floating around that had gotten hired in the 50s or, you know, early 60s. And, you know, these guys were no joke. They just played by a different set of rules. Was that shot stopper technology around when you were on the road?
No, I never heard of it. Shot stopper technology. I have never heard of this. Huh?
Yeah.
I never heard of that.
The NYPD is using it now. So in different neighborhoods, it's like a tower or something. And when a gunshot goes off, this thing recognizes it and can pinpoint the area and will dispatch a radio car to that location.
We did. We did have that. That was coming in as I was leaving patrol. Yeah, they have them like in the neighborhoods and they know exactly. Yeah, that the stations had those. I didn't know they were called shot stoppers, but I know they pinpointed where the shots were coming from. Yeah, there was so many shots down like in Linwood. It was gunshots all night long. But we didn't have it when I was there, yeah.
I mean, in New York City, you have it's all six-story buildings. And if you were doing a midnight, especially in the business precincts, you know, on a Sunday, you hear pop, 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 pop. And you could tell after a while it's a 22. That sounds like sounds like an AK-47. That's a shotgun.
You
like,
could.
Guys, kids, they test fire the guns up on the roofs.
Yeah, you could. It's amazing how you could tell by. Did you ever have like we were shot at a couple times, right? So, you know, and it makes like a zing, right, when it goes by you. So I remember my TO telling me, well, if you hear that, that means it missed you. You know, as long as you heard that, you're not dead. Yeah, because, you know, if it travels
that's
faster than sound.
I've heard that before, and I have heard that sound. And, yeah that's exactly what an old-timer told me. If you hear it, chances are you're alive.
You're okay. Yeah.
Were you guys on solo patrol there, or did you have a partner?
Yep. No, as a matter of fact, all the county cars were the partners, and everybody wanted that. Though I didn't. I liked rolling solo. But the city cars where they had the contracts, they were one-person cars, we called them, right? So they would be one-person cars in the city because it would cost too much for these cities. They would require maybe to hire so many two-person cars, but they like to hire one just because, well, you know what I mean? For the dispatcher, why am I going to have two guys sitting somewhere when I can have one, right? So they like to have people split up in one-man cars, really, because it was better use of resources. You know, if you're sitting on a car waiting for a tow truck, why do I have two guys doing that or, you know, waiting at a crime scene or waiting for the coroner? So that was kind of the reason they didn't like it totally. But, you know, the deputies all wanted two-man cars.
Did you guys carry shotguns?
Yeah, we all had shotguns. We all had the Ithaca 12 gauges, Ithacas. We had Ithacas. But they didn't go to Remingtons until like maybe 98 or something.
See, in the NYPD, they did a pilot program where they had solo patrol sergeants in certain precincts where the sergeant would be by himself and he would carry a shotgun, but they did away with that quickly. The only people that carried shotguns in the NYPD was the emergency service unit. But the funny thing is, when I went to the narcotics division in the early 90s, they were training us on, it was, and I'm not a gun guy, but it was like the Elmer Fudd front break over-under shotgun, you know, two shells, two triggers.
What?
Elmer Fudd.
You're kidding me.
And they brought us out to the range for one day of training. And the logic was on search warrants, there would be a guy with a shotgun. And that would depend on the supervisor. And I remember my lieutenant saying, oh, all right, good. You guys are all trained on that shotgun? Great. He goes, put it on your resume. He goes, we're not taking that thing out. He goes, I've seen far too many accidents with that thing. So it was just one of those things. We got trained on it, and it was never put to practicality.
We had one full day of shotgun training at the range, and we shot skeet, we shot trap, and then we had a combination pistol shotgun thing we had to go through where we used our pistol, we used our shotgun, throw the shotgun down and then go to pistol. And so we used the shotgun a lot. We brought that thing out a lot on patrol. Can you imagine? By 92, when you had to load up your car, we actually had to, not only do we have to take the shotgun, our patrol bags out there, we had to take, then we had a beanbag shotgun too. So we had two shotguns. You had to have the beanbag and you had to have the regular shotgun. And you had to sign that beanbag out and you had to tell the sergeant on your trip slip, we called it, where you checked your car out. You had to, where's your beanbag? And if there wasn't one available, you had to like tell him there's none available and he would check. Did you guys have beanbags or?
This would qualify out at the, what's that? No.
Yeah.
They didn't want us to have toys. They really didn't. You know, like I said about the tasers, only a couple of sergeants carried them. And I don't know if the NYPD is carrying them. They might, but I doubt it. You know what it is? It's such a large department with 40,000 members. So when you guys would qualify, we would qualify once. It used to be twice a year, but then it became once a year. When you guys would qualify with your firearms, how many guys would go at a time?
Okay, we ended up having to go once a year, and then we had trailers. So they would go around to a station. Okay, the trailer is going to be at this station, and then usually it's close to within. And so then you would go to that trailer. And then during that qualification period time, it might be a week, then you could go anytime 24 hours. There had to be a range guy in that trailer. So if you were working somewhere at 3 in the morning, you could just go to the trailer, go qualify, and then you were done, back on patrol. You could do it while you're working.
Really? No, with us, it was an all-day affair. So the way it worked with us is, and it was actually close to where I grew up in my neighborhood. It's this facility called Rodman's Neck. You would never know it was there. It's in the Bronx, right between City Island and the Long Island Sound. And you would get a note, your administrative lieutenant at some point during the year would hand you a slip, say, listen, you got to go to the range tomorrow, a day after tomorrow. And it was an all-day event. And the NYPD... sometimes there'd be 200 people there to qualify at a time.
What?
Because the department is so large. Yeah. So you would get there, say your tour started at 7 a.m., there would be guys out there parked out there at 5 a.m. trying to get in first, and they had different relays. And you would get there, and it was like a firing squad. So each relay had 50 people in it. So it sounded like a Civil War reenactment, you know what I mean? Especially with the 9mm, and there were 50 guys... and standing alongside each other, shooting at once. And we used to shoot at these metal stanchions that would have a target. And every now and then a round would ricochet off the stanchion. One of my friends got hit in the head. He wound up going to the hospital. But, yeah, guys got nicked all the time with that. But you know what? The department is so large, they've got to run people through so often. That would have been great to just go on duty and get it over with.
You didn't have any of those trailers?
No.
So these trailers, they're like a tractor trailer, right? They set them behind the station, and then they had a part of it was like a little desk. And so you would come into the back of the trailer, the range guy, you give him your shooting card, right? And then he would set you up. There's three lanes, and then your target, you put it on, and would send it to the end. And then, okay, round of fire is, five rounds in 3 seconds, boom, boom, boom. Then your next round is bop, 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 reload. And then you were done in like 12 minutes, and then he would give you, okay, you got a 297, and then hand you your card, and you had a stamp on it, and then you were done until the next time.
No.
It was actually, we had to do it quarterly. I think it was three times a year. Yeah, quarterly we had to do it, not just once a year.
I think with us it was twice a year for a while, then it was once a year, but NYPD has been shooting out at Rodman's Neck since, I think, the 70s.
Wow. And
with the 38s, we were using wad cutter, which are lead.
Yep, we did
so
too.
So they
had
to get all that. They dug up all that. It was leaking into the Long Island Sound. So they had to dig up all that stuff when we went to the 9mm. That's what they said they did, at least. But that place has been out there for decades. So you worked on the Sunset Strip, right?
Yeah, out of West Hollywood was the Sunset Strip. I loved working West Hollywood. West Hollywood is unbelievable. West Hollywood is 2 square miles. It's like a $10 million contract. There's a lot going on. There's Sunset Strip on one side of the city, and then there's Santa Monica Boulevard on the other side. So we got one is kind of the entertainment side of the community, and then one is like kind of gay and lesbian and everything else. And so, like, the regular female prostitutes are on Sunset, and down in Santa Monica would be male prostitutes and transgender prostitutes. And so, remember when Eddie Murphy got jammed up? He was down on Santa Monica Boulevard. So that was actually like a man. So, if you remember that, so you and you know if you're going there, you know you're going to Santa Monica. You know what you're getting.
Yeah, it's like Hunts Point in the Bronx. There's no reason for you to be there after a certain time.
Yeah,
it's just it's you can give whatever story you want, and everybody knows what you're doing there and what you're up to.
Matter of fact, the prostitutes on the what?
Did you meet a lot of famous people down there on Sunset Strip?
Yeah, a lot of famous people. Not so much as I did it. I only spent down in West Hollywood about a year, and then I went up to the substation at Universal Studios. That's where I met everybody and got to know some people. Man, that was amazing. Can you imagine? Do you listen to country music at all?
A little.
Yeah.
One of the sheriffs become a country music singer?
No. I was at, there was a movie premiere at the amphitheater, and then I was sitting. So here's me and my wife. We're sitting there at the table after the movie premiere because we're eating with celebrities and stuff. And then we're sitting with this guy. He's eating next to me, you know, not really talking. But then this gal comes and she goes, "Oh, this is my husband. He's a country singer. Oh, Brad Paisley." Brad Paisley was sitting there just alone with me and my wife. But no one knew it. This is like back in, this is like 98 or something. You know, no one knew who he was. But great, nicest guy. But I met all these guys. Yeah, because they used to have the Country Music Awards there at the Universal Amphitheater. So I used to try to work that all the time. So, I mean, I loved that. And then since I was doing stand-up comedy on the side, my lieutenant would try to get me these gigs. You know, hey, you gotta meet these people. So I got you. You gotta work this after party of this movie, you know. So it was fun, man. I really loved it. Yeah.
Whatever goes on in those studios, I mean, does security call you to come in, or do they usually handle things themselves because they don't want it to be a press case?
Yeah. So as far as the sound stages, they got a heavy security down there. A lot of them are ex-cops, usually LAPD or whatever. And they're in a blue jacket or whatever. There's not usually too much trouble. They'll call us down there. So we weren't down in what they call the lower lot too much. Although maybe we'd be taking friends or something down in the tour to show them the Jaws exhibition or something, or where the Beaver's house was or whatever. But that was all in our area. And so on the lower lot, though, the lower lot where the studio, they have their own bank down there. So at one time in the late 70s, 80s, the bank got robbed in the morning, and so they had a takeover, and so they made sure deputies had to be on the studio lot and the city walk every day by 7 a.m. So they made a deal with the studios as far as having deputies there. But mostly we were on the city walk where the restaurants were and the movie theater was, and the nightclubs like Howl at the Moon and, yeah, so stuff like that. The Blues Jazz Club, I forgot the name of it, but yeah. So, yeah, we met a lot of people there. It was fun, you know, so it was great. And it was all a footbeat. We had cars, like, stationed around because we might have to drive our cars down to the lower lot to where there might be a call. But most of the time, we had footbeats. And then if we had to take prisoners, we had, like, a little lockup. We'd take them down to the city at the end of the night or something, you know.
I just thought of a question. Since you worked in Hollywood, were you working that day or know anybody that was involved in that high-profile bank robbery that – those two guys that saw the movie Heat came out armed to the teeth and were shooting it out with the cops for about 2 hours?
Yeah, North Hollywood, the North Hollywood Bank of America. That was probably from where we were. I wasn't on that day or there that day, but it's only like maybe 4 miles from the city walk there in North Hollywood. Yeah, so it's really close by, but man, that was a hellacious shooting. But, yeah, it was. Yeah, we had some crazy things happen around there, but yeah, that was a really fun assignment.
We were watching it in New York because it went live. I mean, because that went on. Yeah. It was a gunfight that went on for, it seemed like, forever, and we were watching it unfold. And you know, we couldn't believe it. It was like, holy shit, these guys are really armed to the teeth, and you could tell they were wearing body armor because the rounds were just bouncing off them. I mean, if the listeners
they had committed, they had committed many robberies prior to this, usually armored cars. They had like, I don't know, $500,000-$600,000, And so they were buying all this equipment. They were really well outfitted, and they were really upset. I mean, they would find out how much money was in these banks. They would open accounts there. They did some good, pre-work on this stuff. So they were really upset when they found out there was only like 30 grand in the vault. And if a patrol unit hadn't been growing by and happened to see them, walking in armed, they would have probably not got caught on that deal.
Oh, I didn't.
These guys, they met in the gym, and they had kind of linked up because of bodybuilding, and then they got together, and then they started pulling these armored car robberies, which they were successful for quite a while.
I didn't know that on that heist that went sideways, and then they got into a gunfight with the police, that they had only gotten 30 grand. Yeah, you would think that they would be pissed off.
They were pissed, and that's actually, yeah, and they were so pissed off, that's they actually shot into the ceiling of the bank. And that's why the unit who had seen him go in and they called for help, that's when he said, hey, shots fired inside, and then active shooter type thing. And then really everybody came in, went crazy, right? And so then that's when they got jammed up and they exited the bank. But, man, that was a crazy, amazing. Yeah.
It got to the point, I mean, working in law enforcement, we were watching on TV, it's like, there's no way they're going to let them escape. Like, yeah, they're going to run out of rounds eventually. You know what I mean? It's just like,
yeah,
you can only carry so many rounds.
Man, but they had a lot of rounds, man. As a matter of fact, a couple, like, LAPD guys had to go to a nearby gun store and, had to load up on stuff. They didn't have enough ammo, and they ran out. And, lucky the SWAT team had been training nearby. That's why they showed up, and these guys jumped out, and they just had shorts on. They had been training.
Saw that.
Yeah, so... Man, but they took care of business, but man, yeah. Yeah, LA was like the king of bank robberies, man. They just had a lot of bank robberies. You never caught them because they had a standing procedure. They weren't allowed to ring the alarm until these guys were gone. And they all knew that. These bank robbers knew that. So, they had a lot of bank robberies would occur unless you rolled up on it. You wouldn't find out till after it happened. Did they have the same policy there in New York? They weren't allowed to like ring the bell or?
No, they did ring the bell.
Oh, okay.
They'd ring the bell. Did you guys have a good working relationship with LAPD, or was there like a rivalry?
A little bit of rivalry, but no, we had a good working relationship with them. And, we got along pretty well. We got along great. Once in a while, you'd argue over areas or, some overlapping areas. Like where the city walk was, most of the city walk was in the county area, but half of it was in LAPD's. And then there was one nightclub that was actually in LAPD's, but we would handle it. And then there was a Hilton right off of the city walk that was really LAPD's. But, for us at city walk, we could be there in 30 seconds. So if there was, we'd just run down there and handle stuff eventually the Hilton thought that we handled everything. So when someone came up with more serious, we would tell them call LAPD, and then they'd have to wait 1 or 2 hours, and then it would be, why, how come you guys aren't helping us? And they might call the sheriff, and how come you guys aren't, we have to, hey, listen, you're not really in our territory. We would just handle it because we're there, because
right.
Most of the time it would be something minor of a trespass. Hey, get out of here. So we would handle stuff. And then, so LAPD, but the LAPD knew, they knew that, where the line was, kind of. Like the main parking lot of the city walk where all the restaurants were was LAPD's, but we handled everything in there. Of course, then we had a kidnapping rape there, and we thought, oh man, we don't want any part of this. So we called LAPD. You guys, this is what you got. Hey, wait a minute. That's not ours. Oh yeah, it is. Then we'd have our maps out, right? No, see, here's the line, and kind of crazy, but we got along great. There was always rivalry because of, sports and whatnot. We'd have sporting events where we competed against them, boxing and running and races and stuff.
Yeah, with the NYPD, there's a rivalry with the fire department. It goes back. It's too much to get into, but they would have that annual hockey game. It was like a boxing match. There was fights on the ice. There were fights in the stands between cops and firemen. It used to go on all the time. I stopped going after a while. It's like I wanted to watch a hockey game, not get my teeth knocked out. It would be quite violent.
Have you heard of the Baker to Vegas relay run?
No.
It's from Baker, California to Las Vegas. It's 20-some miles. So every team has 20-some runners on it. And this is a police relay race It started by LAPD in the 80s, and now people from all over the world come and compete. And I'm pretty sure this year, I went because my stepson is in the race. I'm pretty sure NYPD females or something, they won something, or they were second or whatever. They were major winners. And so there was an Italy team that got like third in their division. And, you know, there's all these divisions, you know, and then so, but man, the awards ceremony has like 2,000-3,000 people there. And NYPD is always there. Canadian Mounted Police are there. Italy's there. Germany there. So it's pretty crazy.
It's good when you go to these events and you see people from different departments. And it's the great thing about doing a podcast now, that I get to meet guys and girls from different departments, and you get to trade stories and you find out things that you would have never have known before.
And no, I know.
You were working during the 92 Rodney King riots, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was actually, and I just left the Compton area. So I was way on the outskirts, but then we deployed a whole unit to go back to Bagat there. But we were one of those units that were like, you know, kept out of sight, you know, waiting to swoop in. So we didn't see a lot of action, but, you know, I was doing stand-up comedy at the time. So I was actually going up on stage too at the same time. And that was kind of, I was a little bit concerned, you know, thinking, because, you know, part of my thing was I'd go up and say, hey, I'm a cop, you know, put that video camera down, or however I would start. So I was a little concerned, you know, but you know what? I never had any trouble. I took care of my business and I grabbed the audience and made them laugh. So I never had any hecklers or anything. But I was literally a little worried because it was such an anti-cop atmosphere going on all around LA.
But during the riots, like, were you guys, I worked during the Crown Heights riots of 90 or 91, and then I worked the Washington Heights riots in 92. Every year you work the West Indian Day Parade, which is a sanctioned riot by the city. I've worked Times Square every year. So I know what it's like to be in crowds and stuff. But, like, during the riots, when we were working, we were doing, like, 16, 18-hour tours for days. Was it the same with you guys, where you just kept coming in and working all these hours and coming back and getting a couple hours sleep?
Yeah, most of the time, they usually put the whole department, and they call 12 and 12s. So you work 12 on, 12 off. You do it that way. Pretty much they got you off, unless, you know, it might go over like you say. But, man, you know, the overtime guy, you know, they make a lot of money on that overtime, you know. I mean, you might go to somebody's house. Wow, you got a brand new, you got a 30-foot Sea Ray. And he goes, yeah, Rodney King. You know, they made so much money during these riots, right? I mean, the overtime, unbelievable.
Was it urban legend, or were there really rooftop Koreans with rifles protecting their businesses?
Yeah. Yeah, there was down there in South Central LA, man. They were, yeah, some of
they
those.
Had enough.
You know, that's all they had. You know, they were, man, some of them would just spray paint their place black owned or whatever, trying to save it, you know, because, man, everything was burned up, man. All those businesses got burned. I got some pictures of me standing. I'm standing in front of these. The whole street's burned down. You know, crazy.
Send them
to
me. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, I will. I'll send them to you. Yeah.
So later in your career, you decide, you know, you're going to retire and you want to pivot and you want to start something else up. You got into stand-up comedy.
I got into stand-up.
Where did you perform?
Yeah, I got into stand-up when I was on the job. So I was on the job doing it, and so I took a bunch of classes. And when I was in the jail, so I could learn how to write my own material. And then I took a couple more classes and I learned how to produce my own shows. And so what I found out was I had a following from the department. So when you first start, you're doing open mics, right? So you're going and people want to come see you. So when they come see you, you know, they might have to wait through 10 comedians to see you do your 4 minutes, right? And they've arranged for babysitting and whatever. So then I got this class and he said, well, you know, you can always... You can rent your own theater. You could hire yourself, hire another headliner. Why don't you have your friends come to pay you to see you? So that's what I started doing. So my first big show, I rented out the Roxy Theater on Sunset Boulevard, which is a major, major iconic nightclub. And I had a success there. And then I ended up, I always had it in my mind. I had seen Richard Pryor on a DVD in the 80s. He did Live on the Sunset Strip. And it was at the Hollywood Palladium. And I said, you know what? Someday I want to perform at the Hollywood Palladium. So after the Roxy, I said, I'm going to go down and see if I can rent out the Hollywood Palladium. So I went in there and talked to the guy, one of the 12 owners, and he was a part-time Culver City police officer, right? So he goes, you know, it'll cost you $5,500 to rent this place during the week. And then that's just four walls. You got to provide lighting, sound, security, insurance. And so I said, well, I had saved up this money, you know, everything I had. I gave it to him. All right, here it is, $5,500, you know. So I had the contract for like 5 months in advance. So then a couple weeks later, he calls me. He goes, Cliff, Paramount Pictures is doing the re-release of Grease, and it's their anniversary date. They want the Hollywood Palladium on that night. I told him, I already have a contract with you. And so they said they're willing to pay you to move your date. So now I don't know why I said this, Vic, but in my head I go, well, you know, I've done a lot of advertising. You know, it'll cost them $9,000 for me to move my date. So he goes, oh, okay. He goes, I know what to do. I'll call him. So he calls me back and he goes, they're going to pay you the $9,000. You better write up an invoice and fax it to Paramount Pictures. I'll give you the fax number. So I had a little company name. I write up this invoice and I send it to Paramount Pictures, right? $9,000, you know, payable to me. And so the guy at the Palladium goes, I'm kind of the whore in this deal. And I go, well, you know, since if they're going to pay me the $9,000, I'm sure I have a brokerage fee for you. And I said, let's meet for lunch. And so I go to hand him, I meet him, and I had an envelope with $500 in it, right? And I go, here's an envelope for you. And he goes, well, wait a minute. Has the studios paid you yet? And I go, no, not yet. He goes, well, when they pay you, I'll take your money. Not until. I don't trust them. I say, okay. And it took him a long time to pay me, but they finally paid me, and then I gave him the envelope. But he was a stand-up guy.
He was.
So I made money on that deal without even opening up the doors. And I go, hey, this is a way to go, man. So I did a couple shows like that. Yeah.
I thought you were going to tell me you got screwed. That's excellent.
No, as a matter of fact, I was able to. The guy who I ended up having open for me, who's now a major headliner, who I hired him, and I paid him. And I used to hire him for all these police functions because people knew I did stand-ups. So they would hire me, and they'd say, we got a budget. Cliff, we need a comedian. I only got like 15 minutes of material, right? So I used to say, well, what's your budget? You know, well, we got like $1,000. You know, I go, no, listen. You know, I'll do the opening, and how about I got a national headliner that'll headline the rest of the show. Sure, whatever, you know. So then I would hire Mike Marino, this guy, and I'd say, Mike, I'm going to take $250. I'll give you $800, whatever. Yeah, I'll be there. So he would do all these police events. He ended up doing LAPD and ours and stuff for him. Well, he became a major headliner, and he performed all over, Laugh Factory, Vegas. So he had the clout to hire his own opener. Well, he would always hire me, you know, whenever he could, because, you know, I put money in his pocket. He always wanted to pay me back. And so I got a lot of stage time on big stages just because of him. Yeah.
That's great.
He did a podcast last night. He's New Jersey's Bad Boy, Mike Marino. He was at the Laugh Factory the night that Mike Richards went crazy,
Kramer.
Made the Laugh Factory famous. Do you remember that from Seinfeld?
Kramer from Seinfeld kind of got heckled, and he kind of went off on the audience, and it got racial, and he was probably the first person to get canceled before you got canceled.
Let me give you the backstory on this, because Mike is supposed to be in the late show. He's the headliner. He gets there early. He's talking to the doorman, and here comes this young black kid with 10 friends, none of them black, just him. It's his birthday party. He goes, oh, it's my birthday. You know, I come down here to the comedy. He goes, oh, who are you here to see? Well, who's on stage? You know, who's playing tonight? Well, Mike's playing the late show. But you know what? He was finishing the middle show. So the guy at the door goes, you know what? Michael Richards from Seinfeld is on right now. Why don't you go on in? Go on upstairs. So what happens is the group goes upstairs, and they're just getting seated, and the waitress is coming around, and they're trying to order drinks. And Michael Richards hears this, and he thinks they're being disrespectful to him, but they weren't. They had just come in mid-show, which they probably shouldn't have let him do that. So then he kind of yelled at him, and they kind of yelled back, hey, it's his birthday, and screw your birthday. And then he went off, and it was too bad that happened. And so then, man, it started going crazy, and they thought there was going to be a riot. People were running out of the place, and then the Fraser Smith was the MC, and the owner said, hey, Fraser, get back up there. And he goes, I don't want to go back up there. No, go back up there. And Mike, go on up there. Yeah, Mike goes, I'm in the late show. He goes, I need you now, Mike. Get on stage. And Mike went on there and he saved the day, man. Yeah, so, and then they had a good night. But anyways, that's the backstory. You got it here, Vic.
No, I appreciate that. I always wondered about, and I'm a huge fan of Michael Richards. I mean, to this day, I still get such a kick out of watching him. He's just such a talented comedian. And we were talking about that earlier before we went live, because people have told me, you know, you should do stand-up. And I said, I could write for a stand-up. I don't know if I could go on there. I think if I got heckled, it would throw me off. Or like we were saying, if someone drops a tray, you've got a cadence in your mind if you're doing stand-up. And if something screws with that, you're like the captain of the Titanic and someone yelled iceberg and everything just goes to shit.
Hey, if you want to do it, let me know. We'll do it. Mike keeps trying to get me back in the game. I haven't had the heart to get back performing, but I performed in New York. We did a Blue Lives Matter comedy tour, and we performed at Gotham Comedy Club with a kid who used to be LAPD, but then Mark DeMeo was NYPD. He did start, I think, that Off the Cuff podcast. And so he was headlining the show. Mark DeMeo did an off-Broadway show called 20 and Out. He did 20 too. And, but you know, we did a lot, but I loved performing at Gotham, man. I always wanted to perform at Caroline's, but I'm pretty sure they're closed now. They got bought out.
I think you're right. I did hear that.
The guy who owned the building, Caroline's was in the basement, so it was different than the upstairs. And so the guy, there was a rent dispute, but that was the iconic club. But if you ever wanted to do it, I always get the... And so the guy, Mark DeMeo, hooked me up with the guy who worked Homicide. I can't think of his name, but he's on it. He's the head guy now on Off the Cuff. He was a Homicide detective. And he talks about in 9/11, right? There was so many bodies. They put him on a barge, right? You know that? And they put the barge off, like offshore in lower Manhattan. And then all the seagulls started coming on this barge. And actually, they were going after the bodies. And so he kind of talks about that on stage. And he did it once, and it kind of brought the crowd down, you know, because it was kind of like dark, you know.
That's about as dark as it's going to get.
Yeah. But he did a good job. This was in... But I can't remember his name now, but man, you would be really good because you got high energy. And the thing is, like my teacher told me, cops have a unique perspective. It's different. It's no longer, you're not just telling dick jokes. You're actually telling real life things things that people like true crime. And so, oh, you were there. You were behind the tape and you're telling these stories. People want to hear that. And then if you can make that funny, then you're different than the other 85 guys that are performing all the time, you know?
Well, think about it. And you've told a couple of stories that you've got insight of what happened, you know, down at 9/11. You've got insight of what happened the night that, unfortunately, Michael Richards' career got a bump in the road.
I've got
stories about a guy moving a dead body to avoid working overtime. I mean, you know, this isn't... You work at Home Shopping Network or Kinko's and there's nothing wrong with that. But luckily for us, we had a career that people find interesting and we're able to get into writing and podcasting that we're in a niche. You know, we've got things. And speaking of which, you've written a series of books. One's in back of you. Could you grab that, the Deputy book, and tell us what that's about?
Yeah, this is my best one. This is called Deputy, and it's 35 years as a deputy sheriff from upstate to L.A., and I use this font wrongly, probably. They came out with a TV show called Deputy. It didn't last very long, but this was the font they used. And so I thought, well, that's going to be popular, maybe. But it's a memoir of my actual experiences because, you know, I went from car deer accidents in upstate New York to gang shooting in L.A., and so it's kind of a unique perspective to having gone, you know, driving around in the trees, and then I'm down on the Sunset Strip, you know. And so it's just kind of true stories of how what my career was in both departments.
And what are the names of your other books?
I have another book called The Truth About Cops and Why You Should Trust Them. I just felt compelled to tell people really the truth as to what people go through to get hired in the police department, right? Because people listen to the news and they think, oh, you just pick people up off the street and they become cops. It's such an arduous process, the background process, you know, to find out what people actually go through to try to weed out bad people is pretty amazing to the lengths the departments go. And I thought, man, if people only knew, you know, that there is due diligence in trying to get the best candidates and try to, nobody hates bad cops more than good cops. And I just think people were getting the wrong picture from the news. And I did one on public speaking for fun and money because I like public speaking. I did some leadership classes and kind of went together with my stand-up comedy. And so it's got public speaking for fun and money. So how to turn your love for public speaking, or if you want to be a public speaker, how you can turn that into a career and make money at it, because you can really create some great value no matter what you're bringing to the table, because everybody has a unique story and it's worth something to somebody else.
And you wrote a health book too, didn't you?
It was called The Vegan Fountain of Youth. My dad had died of a heart attack, and then I watched this show on Netflix called Forks Over Knives, and these two heart surgeons got together and how they turned around heart disease basically with diet. But you know what? I've gone mainly now to a plant-based. It's too hard. When something's all or nothing, it's hard to stick to it. But if you can have some flexibility to it, you can maintain your health without having to restrict what you enjoy.
And where can we find your books?
They're all on Amazon, brother. They're all on Amazon. And I think two out of the three, I also did my own audiobooks. This is on audiobooks too. So you can get this on audio, Kindle, e-reader, and also on paperback, obviously. And I enjoy writing. I'm sure you do too. And it's funny because there's actually a large community of police writers out there, which I think is great.
Tell, and if there's anybody out in law enforcement listening, don't think you can't do it. I did it. Cliff did it. And there's a lot of other guys that did it. And the rising tide lifts all ships.
That's right.
Every cop's got crazy stories and interesting stories. Write them together, put it out there and let you'll make a little bit of money and you'll get your story out there. In addition to that, you're also doing podcasts. What's the name of your show and where we can find it?
It's the Cliff Yates Show, and it's on YouTube if you want to watch it or see it there. And it's also on iTunes, Amazon Music, and Spotify, and I think a couple other ones. It's all over, the Cliff Yates Show, and it's my stuff's all about personal growth, motivation, inspiration. I went into kind of a negative mindset in the department, and things weren't going for me too well in the department either. And then I went to a Tony Robbins seminar, and I got my real estate license, and I went to some training. And then when I changed, things started to change for me. Next thing you know, things looked great for me in the department. I made sergeant and turned things around. And so just my message was, it's nothing outside. Everything is within us. Is if you want to change, you have the power to change yourself, and that'll change everything for you, believe me. So that's the message I like to send. So I'm into that stuff.
Hey, listen, there's nothing, we all need a little bit of positivity from time to time.
Yeah, I'm into philosophy
Well, I've been lucky enough to be a guest on Cliff's show. And if you work in law enforcement and you want to be a guest on his show, Cliff, where can people get a hold of you on social media to reach out?
Well, Cliff at CliffYates.com. CliffYates.com, my name is the URL, and I've got my books on there, and it's got my podcast on there. And I don't know when your episode's going to play, but you're coming out on August 17th will be your episode. That's going to be very popular because, come on, NYPD, retired detective, author. It's going to be amazing. I hope everybody's going to listen to you.
Well, if I can get the editing done tonight, it'll probably, this will drop later this evening. Cliff, I want to thank you. You are a great guest. I appreciate you coming on the show. I'd like to have you on again because I'm sure you got more stories that we haven't even gotten to. I'd like to have you on again.
Same with you, Vic. Let's keep going together. I just think to have community. Not to keep you any longer, but just remember getting together with cops over coffee and just laughing and telling stories. And now we can let other people in on that, and we can get together, have coffee, and tell more stories, and it's fun.
Thank you, Cliff. I appreciate it.
Thank you, brother.
Okay, I want to also thank everyone for tuning in, especially my listeners in White Plains, New York, Waxhaw, North Carolina, Dundalk, Maryland, and Brisbane, Australia. If you have a business or product you'd like to promote on my show, especially those of you that work in law enforcement, drop me a note on Twitter or Instagram, @VicFerrari50, and we'll talk. If you enjoy the content, please check out my Amazon books. Type in the name. Well, go to Amazon and type in my name, Vic Ferrari Like the Car, where you can preview all my books for free, including NYPD Law and Disorder. Don't forget to check out Cliff Yates's book, Deputy, on Amazon, and the price point is right at $8.99. Thank you for tuning in, and I'll have another episode out next week.